I am going to talk about some national issues tonight. As I travel across the country, I have noticed something in the last few years, and I've noticed that we are becoming more involved locally or provincially. Now, I really believe in local politics, as we all do, but I've noticed a waning of the concept or the an analysis, perhaps, or a vision of the national scene, and I think that's perfectly predictable, as we predicted at the time, and Murray and Art QBSC in the room, and so many of us in this room fought so hard when we first fought against the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement, and then against NAFTA, and against all the deregulation, and against all of the cutting of all of the ribbons, I call them ribbons of interdependence. It was bound to happen that we were going to lose some of those keystone issues that kept us together. Losing the Canada Assistance Plan is just one small example of losing the concept of a national standard for social assistance. And so more and more and more we're dealing with services that are being broken or clawed back or privatized by our provincial governments, and so the fight has gone provincial. And so I want to tonight talk about the national and international scene, and as I know that the fight that you've got here against the Campbell government is very powerful and it's very strong and it's immediate, and you must fight it, and there's no question there whatsoever. But I do want to say to you tonight that there is something else happening at the federal level which is getting very little attention by anybody. Certainly the mainstream media has no desire to let us in on any of this, and certainly the big business community wants us as quiet as possible, because they damn near lost the last time they tried to have a public fight about our relationship with the United States. So but what's happening at the federal level will impact on whatever you're fighting for or against here. So I'm going to roll us out of British Columbia for a few minutes and talk about this thing that some of us are calling deep integration, deep continental integration, NAFTA +++, and so on. Now, first thing I guess I want to say, I want to establish what I'm talking about, because this is not a fear or a threat, this is a reality. For several years now, a plethora of task forces and cross-border working groups, coordinating committees, consultations have been operating to harmonize. No, wait, I'm going to have to think about this. A musician just said to me, harmony's good. You're thinking unison is not good, so I'm going to have to try to think about the language here. I have been using this term. But to bring together and to operationalize North American regulations and standards, homeland security measures, economic policies towards the creation of a fortress North America. In effect, they're talking about creating are in the process of creating a common market, a North American common market, which would be one trade bloc, so we would negotiate with the United States as one trade bloc at the WTO. And this would be comparable to the European Union, but without the environmental and social safeguards that were originally built into the European Union. Now, I'm telling you this is already happening. Fortress North America is the brainchild, you will not be surprised to hear, of the big business community in Canada, particularly the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, which is the same group as used to be the Business Council on National Issues, who brought us the first two trade agreements, the same Tom DeQuino, same 150 big corporations. They just don't want to talk about national issues anymore. They've outgrown such things. And the right-wing institutes, research institutes and think tanks like the C.D. Howe Institute and the Fraser Institute. Now, this lobby has been promoting this harmonization since NAFTA, under which they did very well. As you know, we at the time said, you're going to put all our eggs in one basket, and sure enough, as a result of these trade agreements, almost 90% of all our exports go to the United States, making us very vulnerable when the U.S. says no, for instance, on softwood lumber. But they've done very well by it. The 150 companies in this lobby group were worth about $1 trillion 15 years ago. Their net worth is now about $2.5 trillion. So it's been a very, very good agreement for these folks. Well, then came 9/11, and suddenly they had a real excuse to say to the Canadian people, we now have to offer up everything left in the store. As Marie says, you know, I give you everything or everything plus, and that's my final offer. Suddenly, continued trade access to the U.S. markets was dependent on convincing the U.S. that the border could be secured, and that that meant offering, this is from the business point of BCN, or the Canadian Council of Chief Executives point of view, they say they have to harmonize not only all aspects of trade and border policies, but continental security, defense, and resource policies as well. Now, when they're challenged about the far-reaching implications of what they have promoted, the Canadian Council of Chief Executives simply says now that because the economies of our two countries have merged so deeply, there is no point in Canada having its own regulatory regime or own domestic laws. They actually say that. There's no hiding what they're saying. It's just that it has not been published very much. And in fact, they call the regulatory differences between our countries the tyranny of small differences. So this officially started, or post 9/11 officially started, with a report from the C.D. Howe Institute, which they called the Big Idea, and it was called Shaping the Future of North American Economic Space, a Framework for Action. And C.D. Howe argued that Canada should entice the U.S. government into deeper economic integration in order to keep that border flowing by offering full cooperation with the war on terror, more control over Canada's energy supplies, and full harmonization of our regulatory regime. 13 reports followed from the C.D. Howe Institute, which have been a blueprint. The next year, the Canadian Council of Chief Executives launched their North American Security and Prosperity Initiative, which the National Post called a blueprint for a powerhouse North American trading bloc to take on the world, shielded by a fortress North American-style defense perimeter. And only months later, a task force on the future of North America was set up by the big business lobby, the U.S. Foreign Relations Committee, and the big business lobby in Mexico. And the Canadian arm of it was chaired by John Manley, who was Chrétien's deputy prime minister and a hawk. And Tom DeKino of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. And they called their report a bold vision for regional integration and a sweeping new plan for the continent. This is their language. And they called for a common North American brand name, trade bloc, a security perimeter, one common passport, one common immigration and refugee system, a customs union, a common currency, one inspection grid, one testing regime. So if something has been given the okay in the United States, we couldn't have a separate set of rules around it, like bovine growth hormone, which we managed to keep out of Canada, an integrated electrical grid, and a North American resource pact, including energy and water. The Toronto Star called the task force report a new vision for a fortress North America in which the continent is wrapped in a security perimeter from the Arctic to the Guatemalan border. So no surprise when Vicente Fox of Mexico and George W. Bush of the United States and Paul Martin of Canada got together in Waco, Texas this past March, they signed an agreement. It's called the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, and it is almost identical, word for word, to the blueprint that was put out by these other groups. Perhaps not as detailed as what the task force outlined, but they actually even used the same kind of language as the big business lobby group has using. Weeks later, Reg Elcott announced what they call the Smart Regulation Initiative, and that's a promise to work with U.S. regulators to revise and harmonize regulations in areas as diverse as food inspection, drugs, seeds, health and safety, and the environment in order to integrate markets across the continent. And then this past June, a high-level report to the leaders was made by the very senior ministers in the three countries in order to lay out the plan in order to carry out what was signed, the partnership that was signed. And they lay out a very detailed blueprint for harmonization of energy, nuclear security, and regulatory regimes across the border. Now, I bet you haven't read about this on the front page of your newspaper, have you? I bet if you had, you'd be a little concerned about it. And what we've done at the Council of Canadians and in my book, we have outlined this in great detail. And if you want to see any of these reports, they're all on our website, and I describe them in detail in the book. Now, the potential of this is huge, and there is absolutely no debate yet in this country around it. And there's only one sector dictating the terms and conditions of this process, and that's the big business community. And I would be concerned about this under, in any case, but I am doubly, triply, hundredfold concerned that we are doing this with George W. Bush's administration, because this is arguably the most right-wing, anti-environment, anti-human right, anti-social right president in recent American history. And I did a lot of research on George W. Bush and the people who brought him to power, and I believe that we are looking at nothing short of a revolution in the United States. And what really is so important for us to understand are the structural changes that have been made in the United States under that man in the last 4.5, almost 5 years now. The plan was made, laid out by Karl Rove, the famous Karl Rove, years ago. He said, we will build a movement of the right, and we will bring together different groups that may not look as if they have a lot in common at first, but they will work in common cause, and we will get rid of every living, breathing liberals, what they call anybody who doesn't agree with them, from every level of government, from school boards to the Supreme Court, every level of elected government. And they have set out to do this, and they are doing it systematically. Karl Rove targeted, he calls them the new trade unions, right-wing evangelicals. He says they have been disenfranchised from politics, and if we can just harness their power and their voting power, we can permanently put this revolution into effect. George Bush is surrounded, not only has he been put in power by people with this belief, but he is surrounded by people with who believe in what's called end time, and that is that God is going to bring soon, many people is going to bring a time when many people are taken up into heaven, and those who are left behind will either have to make a decision to somehow convince God that they can come up as well, or they're going to die horrible deaths. And this will be, this will precede Armageddon, and Armageddon is going to come after floods and pestilence and war. So the Iraq War was one of the signs that Armageddon is coming, and therefore the Iraq War was good. And it's very, very important to let it, not to take care of the environment, because environmental degradation is one of the signs that Armageddon is coming. And there are people around George Bush. I'm not talking about some nuts off in the hinterland. I'm talking about the head of the Senate committee, the Senate majority leader, the former House leader, Tom DeLay. These people deeply believe this. Just one brief example is James Inhofe, who's a senator from Oklahoma. And he's an end time believer. He says there's nothing he's ever called on to decide that he can't find a literal instruction from in the Bible. And he is backed by big oil and hates environmentalists and wants to do away with the Environmental Protection Agency. And he is the head of the Senate Environment Committee, just to give you one example of what we're talking about. Now, they married up with the foreign policy hawks, the Wolfowitzes and the Pearls and the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds, who have been waiting 30 years for this revolution to cement in order to bring forward their very aggressive foreign policy. And they don't have often a lot in common with the religious right, but they have brought, they've come together in common cause, and they believe that the U.S. is destined to be the world's sole superpower and should not be ashamed to use its might to promote its values and interests around the world. And of course, it's under this group that George W. Bush announced the first strike policy, whereby the United States can strike first at any country whose values it, with whom it disagrees on values. And of course, backing all of this are the big business interests that are making a killing under the new regime, and that is energy, security, what they call data mining, because what they want in the end is to have information on every living, breathing person on Earth, all put in master computers, so that they then mine this information to see if they can figure out what kind, you know, who might be a terrorist, and to cross-fertilize this information. And of course, defense. And the defense spending has dramatically increased under George Bush. And I outline in the book the deeply close relationship between the large defense companies like Lockheed Martin and the Pentagon. And it's just an open revolving door. One day you're the corporate VP of, you know, one of the big defense companies, the next day you're a senior advisor in the Pentagon, or maybe you didn't even quit your job and you're a senior advisor anyway. These people are making policy. And there has been a massive buildup of defense in this term. This year alone, I estimate, if I just put all the sort of different stats together, 2005-2006, that the United States will spend U.S. $1 trillion between its military budget, its war in Iraq, and its war on terror. $1 trillion. So, of course, what it's doing is sucking up all of the infrastructure and the social structures and education funding and so on from its people in order to pay for that. Of course, we saw that in New Orleans. Bush refuses not only to reduce the nuclear stockpile, but he's dramatically increased it. And in fact, they are now taking the arms race into space. When they were first elected in their first term, Rumsfeld was put in charge of a task force on space. And he warned of a space Pearl Harbor and said the United States has to get there first and maintain superiority. You can ask, I mean, you don't listen to me. You can, I quote at least half a dozen of these senior guys, but I mean, scratch any of them. This is not, you know, this isn't a secret or anything. General Lance Lord, who's chief of the Air Force Space Command, says, and I quote, "Space superiority is essential to our vision of controlling and fully exploiting space to provide our military with an asymmetric advantage over our adversaries. Space superiority may not be our birthright, but it is our destiny. It is the American way of fighting." Or as Rumsfeld also says, "We got there first, we've got space superiority, we like it, and we're going to keep it." Now, to pay for this war, as I say, Bush has made war on a different kind of war on his own people. In the area of human rights, through his Homeland Security Act, through the Patriot Act, he has created a frightening, frightening situation in the United States. He has created what people are now calling an American gulag, prisons both on American soil and around the world where people are treated abominably. And of course, through his practice of rendition, suspected terrorists are, or even anybody who might know anybody who might have once known anybody who's a terrorist, are disappeared into prisons in Syria and Egypt and other places where they are tortured or disappeared. I quote one CIA operative who says, well, it goes like this. We tell the interrogators what we want to know in the morning, and by the evening we have the information. There are now 5 million people on the U.S. Master Terror Watch List, and they include environmentalists, human rights activists, and civil libertarians. William Schultz, who's the head of Amnesty International, says that the Bush administration has taken the U.S. back to a time before human rights were part of the political vocabulary of that country. On the environment, appalling, appalling record. They have massively deregulated environmental infrastructures. It started in Texas when George Bush was governor, and he introduced the first law to allow large corporate sectors to negotiate with the government their own environmental agreements. And basically, he then said, go and do it or don't do it. Report on yourselves or don't report on yourselves. Pay the fine or don't pay the fine. I don't care. He brought all those people into the White House with him, and they have mercilessly slashed environmental infrastructure. Robert Kennedy Jr. says that Bush and company have launched over 400 major rollbacks of U.S. environmental law, including the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And he says that they have taken the country back decades to a time before ecological consciousness. The assault on families and the working families and the poor are just astounding. And the difference between social classes is breathtaking. In 1960, the wealthiest 20% made 30 times as much as the bottom 20%. Now the top 20% makes 75 times as much. The top 10% in the United States owns 2/3 of the wealth, leading the bottom 90% to own and divide up one-third between them. I went to write stats in a different part of the book about Latin America, and I went to say what we always say, which everybody says, which is the deepest inequality in the world is in Latin America, and I wrote down the new stats, and I went back to the stats on the United States, and I thought that's no longer true. The greatest disparity, income and disparity in the world is now in the United States. Under George Bush, the United States among developed countries ranks dead last in fighting poverty, is at the bottom in terms of functional literacy, has one of the lowest levels of life expectancy, the greatest and most permanent income inequality, and the highest number of citizens without access to health care. They also, at 22% of children living in poverty, are only marginally better than Mexico. The federal minimum wage at $5.15 an hour has not been raised in almost a decade, and 90 million Americans are what they call twice poor, which means that even if you doubled their income, they would still be living below the poverty line. And this stat just blew me away. The Bush administration has cut welfare payments every year since the year 2000 by 13% per year. Can you imagine trying to be a family working with one, two, three jobs to just make ends meet, or getting sick on one of your jobs and losing whatever small insurance you might have had around healthcare and trying to turn to that system? While profits from corporations are soaring and CEOs are taking home unprecedented salaries, the cost of living has grown faster than income for most working families who are now living with historic levels of debt. Now, to stay competitive in the global economy so beloved of the Bush team, American workers are being told to take huge cuts or lose their jobs. I'll give you as an example the workers at Delphi Corporation, which is an auto parts company. They have been asked to take a two-thirds cut in their wage or see their plants across the United States close. How's that for a, you know, do you want to be shot or hanged? Now, what's this going to mean for Canada? Well, it's already had very serious implications. We have already started to merge our systems around security and defense and in a whole host of other areas. We've brought in C-36, which is a draconian piece of legislation, and I've got a whole chapter called Enemy Creep on what we've done in this country and how dangerous it is. We've brought in the something called the Safe Third Country Act, which is that we now have to turn back refugees who, largely from Latin America, who have to come across the United States to seek refugee status in Canada. We're now required to turn them back at the border. Many of them are escaping the kinds of paramilitary squads that have been supported by the American administration, and they're being turned back to try to seek asylum there. Well, you can imagine, of course, they're just being sent back to their country of origin. And we have the Patriot Act. Murray mentioned this. You should know that the Patriot Act says that any American corporation operating anywhere in the world, on U.S. soil or anywhere else, must share with the Homeland Security Department whatever information it requests on their files if requested. They cannot say no. And Lockheed Martin, the world's weapons, biggest weapons manufacturer, has the contract to deliver the hardware for the Canadian Census. This, you know, these are the folks that designed the missile guidance system, you know, the warhead. And I don't like the thought that they have my postal code, you know, and your postal code. The Stats Canada says, well, don't worry, we won't let them share that information. Lockheed Martin makes billions and billions of dollars from the Pentagon. They're going to turn around and say no if this information is requested. The Civil Liberties Monitoring Group in Canada says Canada is creating an irreversible and incremental process that will alter forever the fundamental values, civil liberties, and constitutional guarantees that Canadians until now have viewed as the pillars of Canadian democracy, particularly with regard to due process, the right to privacy, and legitimate political dissent. On the issue of defense, it is true that we said no to ballistic missile defense, and that's because Paul Martin, in spite of his desire to do so, to say yes to it, and his promise that I think he did make to the United States, was forced to listen to the Canadian people and read the polls as he's in a minority situation. However, you should know, and also this did not get much press, but in this past April, they finally published the long-awaited foreign policy review, and it mirrors almost identically the foreign policy position of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, including a recommendation for a North American security and defense partnership. I believe they're bending over backwards to make up for the decision not to participate in ballistic missile defense. You should know that Paul Cellucci, who's the former ambassador from the United States to Canada, says his only instruction from George Bush when he was sent to Canada was to get Canada to increase its military spending. And we have just announced that spending in the recent budget of a few months ago. The increase will be to $20 billion a year for the military, which is the highest per capita spending on military since the Second World War in our country. Now, this is all so that we can fulfill our new agreement on interoperability of both technology and strategy. And this is an agreement that has been made between our countries. And it's coming at the expense of our support for the UN. Steve Staples at the Polaris Institute estimates that 12 years ago, for every $10 that we spent on military and defense, over $9 was on UN peacekeeping. Now, for every $10 we spend only 31 cents on UN peacekeeping. On energy, I kept asking myself, well, what is it? They keep talking about this, they want a new energy pact. And I keep thinking, what more could they get than they got under NAFTA, which contained a proportional sharing agreement? We are now sending almost 70% of our oil production to the United States, and we have to keep doing that. So now, in order to supply ourselves, do you know that we're importing almost half of our oil needs in Canada? No wonder the bills are so high, because we can't cut back. And of course, now we're going into the Athabasca tar sands, and now, of course, big American companies are coming in wanting to cement those tar sands. So I racked my brains and read and read and read, and one day when I was out jogging, it popped into my head. Of course I know what they want. They want deregulation of our environmental rules around searching for new energy supplies and around the Mackenzie Valley pipeline. Like, it just seemed to me so clear that what they want, and not to forget that the United States did not sign Kyoto and Canada did, and they don't want to be bound by Kyoto rules when they take over the tar sands. On water, nobody will say publicly that they're talking about water, but we got a hold of the leaked minutes of one of the meetings of the task force on the future of North America. And they said that all three countries agree that water will be on the table one day, sooner than later, but that it's too politically iffy right now to put water out there. And I tell you, I travel a lot in the United States. I've been recently in Lubbock, Texas, and Kentucky, and I've been in Idaho, and I can tell you it's not a drought they're having, okay? This is not a drought. The U.S. Midwest has got the least amount of water that it's had in 500 years. There's a crisis coming, and they are going to be looking sooner than later north for our water. Healthcare, I don't have to tell the people in this room about the urgency of this post the Supreme Court decision. Dr. Chowley, the doctor who led the fight to the Supreme Court, is going all over the United States telling American for-profit hospital corporations to come on up to Canada because NAFTA's been broken and you can come here and make money. He's the darling of the Enterprise Institute and all of these right-wing foundations. We're going to have to fight very hard if we're going to stop the further erosion and privatization of healthcare. And finally, the last concern I want to throw out to you, and this chapter kind of blew me away, because one of these things, you got an idea of it, but when you start to really research, you realize the depth of it, and that is the effect on our environment and health and safety regulations of this move now to merge the regulatory regimes with the United States. They brought in this smart regulation, which is just a fancy word for deregulation, and every department in the federal government has been told to bring in a plan, and that plan is then to be merged, and there are dozens of cross-border committees working now to merge every aspect of seeds, food, the Food and Drug Act, which we are about to allow to change from having a being based on the precautionary principle to being based on risk assessment, which is essentially where you say, how many people can we allow to get sick or die and still keep this product on the market? Literally, there's a whole science around it. And the guy who designed the science and set it up, the department at Harvard University that got funded by the big business community in the United States, is now running the regulatory regime in the White House. And he's the guy who designed the whole concept of risk assessment, and we are adopting it wholesale. And I have to tell you that I came upon this thing, and I'm going to tell you in a second, by accident. But did you know that Environment Canada has opened up under its smart regulation regime the same kind of discussions with big business to set up a voluntary code? They're called sectoral table negotiations, and Industry Canada, Environment Canada, and they're starting with chemicals, energy, automobiles, mining, and forestry, those five sectors. And they're actually sitting down negotiating so that these sectors can be removed from current legislation and current regulations and negotiate one-on-one a new set of agreements around so that Canada can be competitive. And Environment Canada has to is supposed to both look after the environment and help Canadian industry become competitive at the same time. So I think we have a problem, as you can see. Deep integration of our continent is happening steadily, comprehensively, and below the radar screen. And it is being driven almost exclusively by the needs and interests of the big business community and the voices of those concerned with healthcare, education, human rights, social justice, the environment, international development, cultural diversity, and workers' rights have been totally and completely sidelined. And I say it's time for this to change. The Council has launched a campaign to halt and reverse this process. We believe that joining the Bush Revolution would be the worst possible thing for Canada and the world. And make no mistake, by having signed this partnership agreement in Waco this past March, Canada is really becoming an enabler, allowing the Bush team to stay its destructive global course. A better course would be seeking out the many millions of Americans who distrust and dislike what's happening to their country under this administration as well, and working with them and Mexicans and others from the hemisphere to build a very different kind of future for this continent and for the hemisphere. So we are calling for a full moratorium on this process. Stop now. They're supposed to meet every year. The agreement is each March they will meet and they will report to each other on the progress deepen this partnership and this agreement. It's not to go to Parliament. We have no ability to vote on this thing. Let me tell you, when you read and understand the depth of it, this is, in my opinion, it's more serious than NAFTA. Okay, and yet there's no public debate on this. We're calling for a Royal Commission on Canada-US relations, which would open this whole process up to public debate. We want a Made in Canada energy strategy, a national water policy. We want to stop the privatization of healthcare. We want to reverse this dreadful smart regulation, deregulation process. And we believe that we need to recognize the fact that the U.S. has broken NAFTA by what it's done, disobeying the tribunals on softwood lumber, and therefore Canada is no longer obligated to abide by the terms and conditions of the North American Free Trade Agreement. I'm going to end the formal part of all of this with some, just what I ended, how I ended the book, and then just want to talk with you rather than at you. I wanted to, you know, when you write a book like this, and Murray will, I bet my bottom dollar agree with me, you come to the end and you start to make a list of what should be, and it gets so bloody boring. And again, jogging one day, out popped a different way of looking at it. And so what I asked then what I consider to be the four great questions of our time, because I think there are these very powerful, pressing questions, and to ask the question, what is Canada prepared to do on them? And by taking this next step of deep integration with the Bush administration, how are we not making a backdoor decision on these great issues? And so I'll just end with these four, what I think are the four great questions of our time. The first is how to deal with the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, especially the weaponization of space. This is just, The China and Russia have made a detente. They've said we can't allow the United States to go into space. We can't allow them to nuclearize, put nuclear weapons in space, and stay here and not do it. We are on the verge of a brand new level of a brand new world Cold War. And we know what the American response is. They've been made it very, very clear. They've got space superiority. They intend to keep it. It doesn't matter how much it costs. And that $1 trillion I talked about does not include what they call the black budget, which is the budget for space war. What will Canada's position be on this? So far, it looks as if we're going to be an enabler by making this, bringing this interoperability process to North American defense. The second great question is how to deal with the deepening poverty and injustice within countries and between countries, particularly between the global north and the global south. And there are some very powerful recent books and studies that say, in fact, don't listen to the World Bank when they say things are getting better. Things are getting profoundly worse, with a super rich class being created in every country in the world, including China and India, and life becoming deadeningly worse for the majority. Again, we know what the U.S. response is: more economic globalization, more unregulated markets, more privatization. They forced the developing world to privatize healthcare and education. Now they're saying, and water's next. And so we're in this big fight to stop the theft of the world's water. What will Canada's response be on this? The third great question of our time is how to end, is how to end fundamentalism, extremism, violence, and terrorism. Now, we know what the answer from the Bush administration is. It's more bombs, borders, and Bibles. And the question for Canada will be, can we conceive of another way of coming at the whole question of security from a position of the question of human security in a much fuller definition? And the last of the great questions, I think, for us to start to deal with, and of course so many people are trying to sound this alarm, and that is to acknowledge and deal with the ecological limits of the Earth, particularly climate change and the growing crisis of the energy and water shortages in our world. And again, we know that the United States refuses to sign the Kyoto Protocol, continuing to lead the world in energy consumption, and now is heading to produce the worst greenhouse gases in the world with the production of more mining in the Athabasca tar sands. Where will Canada stand on this? And by signing this agreement, in effect, we've already said, we side here. No matter what Paul Martin says around, we're going to stand up to George Bush on softwood lumber, what's really happening is something else. So there is no more important question in my mind than to answer, or more important task for us than to answer these questions and to try to position Canada in a very different place. The world is in desperate need for counterweights to the Bush administration, and Murray mentioned some of them. I would add that we've had the wonderful example of France and the Netherlands saying no to the one big market model of the European Union, which has killed that model. Now they're going back to looking at Europe as more of a political and social model. Or with the magic that's happening in Latin America and the fact that the leaders came back from that meeting empty-handed and do not have a free trade area of the Americas, and we're not going to get it. And when Martin and Bush say, well, we'll do it without Brazil, I say, get a map, go back to grade 8. Get your old grade 8 atlas out and look at Latin America, look at South America, and try to do that without Brazil and Venezuela and Uruguay. And I mean, are you insane? Of course you needed your deal with the few little small little countries in Central America, which Bush just about had to beat the whole world up to get past. You're not going to get that because the world's saying no. And I'm off in December to Hong Kong for the WTO ministerial, where I am priming myself to be there for the third failure of that dreadful institution. And I tell you, it's going to happen. Canada's narrative, and we've done many things wrong, but we've done some things very right. And we did the one thing I want to say that we did right was that we built these ribbons of interdependence because we knew if we didn't share, we wouldn't survive. So few of us living in this great big harsh, cold environment, we knew that if we didn't share with each other and bring a public face together with private enterprise, we wouldn't survive. And we built a very important mixed economy so that the public sector did things that the private sector could not. Looking after people in remote areas, delivering the mail to places that it wasn't economically feasible to do, bringing trains, bringing healthcare to people. We had to turn to each other for survival. The American narrative has been survival of the fittest. And I tell you, I feel when you look at the four great questions of our time, the answer to those four great questions is sharing for survival, not survival of the fittest. Survival of the fittest is that notion has the same DNA as a cancer cell. It's going to have to turn on its host in order to survive. The world cannot sustain what we're doing to it. And I want our country and the people in our country, the Canadians here, who come from all over the world, who've chosen this place to stand up and say no to this agenda and to be part of a different vision for this continent, for the hemisphere, and for the world. And that is a mighty challenge which I know we're going to take up. And I thank you.